Good morning and welcome to From Now On. During the last 2 weeks of this month, we've been talking about a generation of people who were born during what has been generally called the baby boom of the 40s. In other words, people who are now in their 20s, or late 20s. And we've been looking in the program at some of the influences on their lives, what's made them the kind of people they are. We have also tried to discover what are their particular values and goals. Now, it's obvious that this generation, which has been called for some reason the Woodstock generation, has had a big influence on the cultural, the political, and the religious changes that have been taking place during this decade or the last decade. Among these, probably the most important, are some of the cultural changes that have happened. For this Woodstock generation has obviously had a big influence on theater, on movies, on art, and on music. And it's music we're getting into this morning. In particular, there's been the music that generally goes by the name of rock, which when it started out was not considered to be something much more than a fad, I suppose, but has continued, has even developed. It's been an extraordinary phenomenon of our generation, not only in this country, but around the world. And so we're going to discuss this morning the influence and the meaning and significance of rock as describing perhaps some of the values of this particular generation and as an instrument of social and religious change. It's not too long ago that rock was just, as it were, to be found in funny little records with big holes on them, but now it's everywhere. It can be found in Central Park, in Madison Square Gardens, in Broadway Theater, Philharmonic Hall, and in quite a number of churches. Well, to help me, and I need a great deal of help on this subject, this morning I've got here in the studio on my right, I've got, first of all, to introduce to you Jim Lichtenberg, who is the review editor of the magazine Changes and has contributed to the New York Times and to Q magazine. On my left, first, is Lillian Roxon, who's rock columnist for the New York Sunday News and author of The Rock Encyclopedia. And beside her is Mr. Robert Krizgau, who is music critic for Newsday and formerly wrote for The Village Voice and Esquire. Well, welcome to From Now On. As I said a few minutes ago, I need a lot of help in this program because I know practically nothing about it. I mean, I'm one of those, of course, conscious of the sounds that are going on around me. And as I was saying to Jim Lichtenberg, although not a musical person, I'm very responsive to rhythm. And it seems to me that a certain rhythm is going around the country and around the world just now that says something. Now, let's jump in with a question such as, in the past, a lot of popular songs, music, different generations, has been of a fairly flimsy and sentimental nature, you know, the kind of songs that people used to sing. Now, today, it's been suggested to me that this rock music is more fundamentally serious than the popular music of the past. Is this true?
I don't know. You know, that's the standard rap on rock, and I've been rapping it down myself for 5 years, and I'm not quite as sure as I used to be that it's true. I mean, for one thing, a lot is made of how gutty the rock music of the 50s was, but if that's true, it's true primarily about the way it sounded, the vocal qualities of the singers, which was much more, not as idealized, because hitting the notes wasn't as important. It was more a matter of feeling, and mostly because those people couldn't sing, or at least couldn't sing as singing was understood. I think they were great singers. And also the rhythm. But as far as the lyrics were concerned, the lyrics of a good deal of the music in the 50s was even more pap than the stuff that had preceded, certainly. You're not going to say that Cole Porter didn't write about the real world. I guess maybe it could be said that Cole Porter wrote about the real world for a very extruded segment of a very upper class kind of people and their experiences. But frankly, I think a lot of the meaningful stuff that's done in rock today has the same kind of class bias.
But it was, at least in the beginning, at a certain point in the beginning, it seemed to grow out of the direct experience which the young singers and songwriters had themselves. I mean, if you go the Beatles songs, Dylan songs, a lot of these had to do with the way they reflected on their own daily lives. And in the sense of it, were, if rock at any time was more serious than what preceded it, it was because it was more direct. It was because it was more in contact. I find I lose patience with people, especially recently, when they're writing about things, invented things, as opposed to the things that, that really touch them. I think there's been this a return to what people call singer-songwriters, where individuals write their own music and then sing it, which is, I think, very good because it does get you back to what, in fact, you're experiencing as opposed to concocted Tin Pan Alley-type lyrics.
Oh, I want to make a point that the kind of young man who a few years ago might have been a novelist or a poet is now writing songs and perhaps singing them.
Because he wants to express something serious?
Yes, well, I think I've talked to... let's say someone like Donovan, for instance, because this is someone that older people can relate to because it's gentle, sweet music and it's still something that kids like. But the problem with somebody like Donovan 20 or 30 years ago is that he would have been a poet or a novelist. He would have had a novel in the works. Maybe he
had. Why is that a problem?
No, well, now he won't ever do that novel because he's put it all in the songs so that people who are closing their ears to the music are missing out on a literature.
Yeah, if you're losing in one cultural form, you're gaining in another.
Right. I've often thought that if people don't like the sound, they should at least read the lyrics.
Yeah.
And then maybe go to the sound later.
Right.
Oh, who do you think bears up under reading? I mean, I can't read. The only thing I do when I read a lyric is to put the record in the cell pile.
I've had some nice surprises. In fact, I play a game. I sometimes read them out loud like poetry, and they do stand up. It's interesting. A lot of them don't.
Do you think the words are more important in the music of this generation than they were in the past?
Yes. I mean, a lot of them are very pompous and pretentious little lyrics. I mean, you know, 18-year-olds talking about deep experiences, not always something.
Well, we're talking about going back to the country, you know. I mean, the fact is, you know, there's a lot of received experience which is being regurgitated by singer-songwriters at this time. And I mean, the cliche level is as high as it's ever been.
Yeah.
And it's just
a different cliche.
But the difference is that there are a few geniuses who do fantastic work, but I don't think the run of work is very inspiring.
I've noticed something in my own profession, that quite a number of preachers today fasten on some of the titles of popular songs. You know, it may be a gimmick, but I don't remember this happening before. It's, even in sermons, you know, whole quotations, well, obviously things like Jesus Christ Superstar or Godspell, but even apart from that, they'll take off with some of these particular lyrics. Now, is this rock music expressing some particular protest or some particular view of life that people are putting over?
Well, it wasn't some particular view of life, I don't think, as so much as a view of life, which everyone has. I mean, you go through life and you're viewing it at the same time. And rock at least was an avenue in which you could, in fact, express what was happening to you. You couldn't do it in films. You had to wait till you were 40 and you were a director and you had $40 million behind you and you could... and all the politics, but for a time anyway, a kid who was talented could get up on stage and sing about what he saw and get his friends together and people would recognize him and his peers would respond to him and the record companies realized, oh yes, this is a good way to continue selling records, and there was a certain amount of interchange. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, if there was a certain group of people who were angry about something, well, they'd all get up and talk about it, whether it was the war or whether it was the repressiveness about drugs, if...
but Jim, you know that those themes constituted maybe 3% of the total output. I mean, especially of the songs that were popular and affected people. I mean, people didn't write protest songs. There's never been much protest music involved with rock and roll, which is not to say that it hasn't imbibed other things, but it hasn't imbibed them by writing about the war. Just isn't the way it's done.
One of the things that happens that I've noticed is that there's still good songs and bad songs, you know. And I mean, a good song is a good song and a bad song is a bad, so that it doesn't matter what it's about. Sometimes a very trivial song is a success and works emotionally. And something with very deep meaning is just boring and dull. So it's still, there isn't a rule now that if a song is deep, it works and it's a good song. There's no guarantee of that anymore.
There was something you said to me not long ago that rang a bell, and that is that you felt that this rock music had done something to loosen up people, particularly here in America. Now, from my own observation, even in churches, the trend is to loosen up. You know, people don't go in all sort of, you know, their Sunday best and on their best behavior. They're more natural. Now, I think probably this rock music has done something.
It's done a lot.
To my generation as well as yours.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I have been to, for some reason, because I work with people in the music field, they tend to be younger than myself, say. But they just loosened up people generally. I mean, when I first came here, I came to the United States 12 years ago. I couldn't talk to a lot of people. They're very serious, very pompous.
You came from?
I came from Australia originally. Mm-hmm. And they really were pompous. They were very difficult. I used to go running to England for vacation saying, I really can't talk to Americans. And now it's the easiest thing in the world, you know. And it's just something that happened. I literally saw it happen with the Beatles. I mean, you could watch it happen in a matter of months.
Now, that's an interesting point. Was this something that happened sociologically and then got reflected in the music, or did rock music do it?
Yeah, I was going to say that. It seems to me that to posit that kind of causal relationship is a little silly, but clearly there's a whole lot of forces having to do with affluence, breakdowns of various kinds of economic and political structures that are going to make people loosen up. But it does seem to me that if you want to talk about causal influences, that the Beatles are a real thing. You can really talk about them. They epitomized something, they projected it, and they really moved things. Which is not to say that they themselves weren't moved by the same forces as everybody else, but they somehow caught them, provided metaphors which spoke to a lot of people, and accelerated the rate of change for a while.
Also, there's a thing that I think people have overlooked, is that there was a tremendous amount of idealism being instilled into young people during the 50s. I mean, the people who grew up to the Beatles were in fact taught in their schools, for example, well, medicine was going to cure all diseases, atomic energy was going to be there, we've got the perfect system now, it's democracy, that's politics, we've made the world safe for peace because we fought the Second World War, and that's going to be it. You grew up with all this stuff, and then all of a sudden, wham, here was this group that, like, somehow or other reflected those vibrations, and it was a perfect resonance. I mean, it was just wonderful. It was like falling into something that you've been hearing about all along.
You mean that Beatle thing reflected that kind of idealism?
Wasn't so much specifically the concept's idealism, but it reflected the kind of feelings about life that you were told was going to be your inheritance. You could be happy, you know, Sergeant Pepper, you could walk in Pepperland, you know, the blue meanies were vanishing in the world, you know.
Yeah. But by that time they weren't quite so optimistic. It does seem to me, you know, that what they communicated over and above everything else was sheer joy, and that joy was a function, it seems to me, if you want to get Marxist about it, of class mobility, which all of them had experienced. Mm-hmm. And also, it seems to me, with a sense of the breaking down of the English class system by the use of American art form.
Well, they symbolized that coming from Liverpool. I mean, you know.
Right.
Yeah,
but what they did was that, you see, is that they grasped on this American stuff, and America's always had that sort of symbolic value for English people, and affirmed that they were not locked into this English system, that they were international in some way, and boom.
I'm interested in this international business because we're talking about rock. Now, immediately one thinks of American music, an American phenomenon, and yet here are the Beatles, who were English. Now, did the Beatles try to interpret something they sensed over here, or was the noise that came out of Liverpool, they went to London, they went to New York? How did this happen?
I mean,
the Beatles were the people who set it off, if it's an American phenomenon.
Well, because the Beatles were the equivalent of the folkies over here at the same time. I mean, just in terms of what they were, and given the different sort of educational setup in Great Britain, they were people who like had a more than average passion for popular music, and who looked for the best, the most vital, the most direct music. And instead of finding it in the kind of in Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly, which is what people who were kind of myopic here perceived, they had the perspective on it to perceive that there was this fantastic thing happening in which a whole newly self-defined generation of people, urban, I think, people, was expressing itself and was relating to a multiracial experience, which is, if we want to talk about internationalism, is very, very important. All American popular music is always combined African and European elements. It's the only kind of place that that sort of fusion could occur. And I think that's the reason that American popular music, or one of the reasons that American popular music has been so successful worldwide, is because it two very important musical traditions were fused in one place because of slavery.
Yeah, we're getting very close to something we've been after in this program. We're trying to understand this so-called Woodstock generation and what makes it in any sense different from other generations that have reacted against their predecessors. Now, one of the things that seems to have come up is this new sense of people of this generation being kind of united across the world. This music seems to go almost everywhere, including parts of the world where the kind of music, as I led to understand, is totally different. It seems to appeal. It's as if a great big sort of beat started up, expressing a new sense of unity across national frontiers that wasn't there, say, in the 20s or 50 years ago. Do you think it's true?
To a certain extent, I think that really is true. I think there are two things that that one has to keep in mind. One is that rock is a very sexual music. That is, in a simple sense, it relates to the sexual being inside of each human being. And it doesn't matter what country you are. Basically, the human species is very similar. And this kind of straightforward just response, I think, would come from anyone. I think that's a lot has to do with its African origin, and that it's primitive in the best sense, that it's the first, it's like one of the basic elements in mankind is its sexual nature, and rock is in a sense a very direct mirror of it. The other thing I think that happened is that rock is electric. If it's not literally electric, there's an electric feel about it. And I think that's very exciting. I think that was a very exciting discovery for the human race, to get into electricity. I mean, a lot of people, when they're playing their guitars, they're really playing electricity. And the notes aren't so important so much as the release of energy.
Yeah, I did want to say one point about that, and that is that it took me a long time to realize this, but sometimes when music is very loud, which a lot of people don't think alike, I don't know the science behind this, but it acts on your skin surface in some way. And that is why during, say, a concert by the Grateful Dead or even Grand Funk, people tend to take off their shirts because it does something to the skin surface. Now, I've watched this happen, and I don't know the basis for this.
Why is it that people don't take off their shirts in the subways?
Because of vibration.
Well, perhaps you pipe some of the music through the night.
But it's... there's a physical effect. Loud music has a definite physical effect, not just on your ears, but on, you know, there's like waves of it coming. I don't. This sounds like I hear voices, but
this is part of the mystical thing too, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think certainly in Grateful Dead concerts. Now, this is a group where people really get into religious trances. Mm-hmm. They say they do. There's a lot of something about the music feels nice. It's nothing to do with what they're singing, or even if the tune is good.
Yeah,
I've seen 25 Grateful Dead concerts in the past 3 or 4 years. I don't love them as much as the real Grateful Dead freaks, because that's impossible. But I sure do love them, and nobody else I've seen 25 times. And that isn't what happens to me. I'm not sorry. I'm glad. You know, I think that that's self-induced hypnosis. That great. They don't do that. They do something entirely different.
Well, why don't you get self-induced hypnosis about... I go to 1,000 boring groups. I wish I could get the self-induced hypnosis on those, but I don't.
Well, they're a wonderful group. They're, I think, maybe the best, the finest collection of musicians operating in the world.
So maybe they're
right
good
now
for people who want to practice self-induced hypnosis.
I think that's true. A lot of the whole rock phenomenon, that there is, in fact, this desire inside this young culture, for a lot of reasons. One is to escape some of the bitter realities of the times. The other is just that youthful thing. I mean, if you've seen really young children, sometimes when they're all playing in a group, like, they'll knock themselves down just for the fun of it. I think that that kind of playfulness carries over, and that this is a really nice, I mean, it creates an atmosphere in which to be playful, in which to get into a trance, in which to blow your mind, even if you're not blowing your mind with a drug.
This is a thing that interests me a lot. I'm learning from you. It seems to me, if I'm hearing you right, that you're saying that rock music is not primarily an escape. I mean, it's not just a great big noise so that you can't hear the beastly noises that are going on in the world. I mean, I think you're saying that. On the other hand, you are saying that it's an escape in the sense, perhaps, of a little back to nature, let your hair down, literally or figuratively, being more natural, It's that kind of escape, which isn't a running away from reality, but coming back, huh?
Sure, it can be.
It depends how it's
used. So a movie's a running away. You know, it's something. Sometimes when the sound is very loud, it just shuts everything else out and it's very relaxing. I mean, I've been to hear bad, noisy groups, and I've walked in with a headache, and I thought, my headache is going to get worse, and it gets better. Now, don't, you know, not because I took an aspirin. But something happens. I don't know what it is. There's all this loud, terrible noise, but it's very comforting.
It's the noise, I think, probably the older generation get most upset about. I certainly, if I go into a restaurant, I mean, I'm wanting just a quiet drink or whatever, I certainly don't want a deafening noise, particularly if I have a book with me I want to read. But I've learned that with this stuff, you give yourself to it. And then I don't mind how loud it is.
Well, you know, Jim talked about the sexuality of the music, and which is another standard rap. It seems to me that what's been overlooked is that sexuality was very closely tied to aggression.
Well,
that the beat, yes, it was sexual, but yes, it was also aggressive, and it was no more one than the other, and it has to do with a certain tying of the expression of sexuality to aggression in a society which is basically sexually repressive. But the loudness, it seems to me, has almost nothing to do with sex, and a great deal to do with aggression. I mean, people feel frustrated and want to let out their frustration.
Funny that, you know, that it doesn't affect me that way, and this may be my generation. I'm a born Scot, and I'll tell you what does arouse, not aggression, but terrific sense, I go and do anything for me. That's bagpipe music, you see.
Now, yes, me too, I love it.
I just do anything, I just blow my top on
that. You know there's a bagpipe hit at the moment, don't you?
Yes,
it's a big, yes. Amazing grace, right.
Yes, so that's really something. But let's get into another item of aspect of this, and that is, what is the black relationship to rock music? Is this the first time that something in the black soul has spilled over, generally, into the music, the culture of WASP America?
I've been having a lot of thoughts about this. You know, first of all, it's not true that rock and roll was the first time that black music ever was part of popular music, because that happened with the swing bands in the 30s, where there were black players and black arrangers. Although the surface was generally kept white, and the black bands very rarely had white followings, although there were a few exceptions to that. Louis Armstrong, I think, was one, and there were others. But what happened in the 50s, it seems to me, was that a white singer, specifically Elvis Presley, learned how to sing with what can only be described briefly as blues feeling. I mean, what that is would have to take a lot of description. And there's just no question that the black influence has grown greater and greater in white music. But unfortunately, what seems to have happened in the last couple of years is that so many white singers have learned to do this that the white audience has no interest in listening to the black singers at all anymore. And so there's this sort of new racism that's developing. I mean, the so-called hip FM stations play a lot less black music than the square AM stations. Oh, I got a letter the other day from some kid who I had written about this in Newsday. He said, well, it's not true that WPLJ doesn't list any black artists, and he listed 10 artists, 8 of whom were sort of new hip toms. And he said, of course, I don't buy any of their records, but I think they're all great artists. Well, I bought black music all the time when I was a kid, because it was the best music. And I still think it's the best music a lot of the times. Right now, there's a lot more vitality in black pop and music, especially the stuff that is dismissed by the so-called hip people as schlock, than there is in most hip music.
Also, what I was thinking was that basically it was the black masters that taught the rock masters a lot of their things. I mean, whether it was the Beatles listening to Chuck Berry or Mick Jagger learning from John Hooker and Fats Domino, or whether it was the fact that a lot of the black groups were in fact the earliest experiences with popular music that this now grown-up generation had. I mean, I remember very clearly Fats Domino and the Platters and the Coasters, and this was stuff that in those days you didn't take seriously. I mean, I was studying classical music then and doing all my Latin homework and so forth, but what was on the radio was, you know, and all the Coasters and Platters hits, and this stuff went in like subliminally, you know. So then when you get people like the Beatles who'd learned from this stuff and in a sense were then re-expressing it in their own way. I think in this sense, black music is just absolutely at the bottom of it. And if you go back through the 50s stuff, then you get to the blues, which I think, and people talk about jazz as being the great American art form, but there was the blues that, you know, I mean, that was Africa living in the Delta, and it was just, mm-hmm. I think it's just phenomenal.
I'd like to make a point that at Beatles concerts, you don't see black faces. Black people don't go to Beatles concerts. I mean, all the ones that I went to, and quite often, for instance, I didn't see black people at Elvis.
No, I saw 16,000 people at Led Zeppelin and the Coliseum, a British blues group. I saw one black face.
Is this part of the new trend towards, you know, segregation, the sense of...
Absolutely. I think that a large segment of the so-called Woodstock generation is really the Altamont generation. People feel completely defeated by all the idealism of the 60s. We've lost it, we've blown it, let's get away, and those that have the money are going to turn into the worst reactionaries this country's ever seen.
Really?
I'm really beginning to feel that way. I mean, I think what's happening in Marin County right now is just horrifying, totally horrifying. Marin County is where all the San Francisco musicians live, and these people are fabulously wealthy. They do a lot of dope. They take a lot of cocaine. Now, since it's fashionable at the moment, they'll get over it. And they barricade themselves against the world in this incredibly pleasant little island.
What's super suburbia?
It is suburbia just carried.
Are you saying that the Woodstock generation, having produced a popular kind of music that was expressing something of the soul of the all kinds of people at that time, are now becoming, are the successful ones, becoming the new kind of capitalist on their own?
Well, a capitalist isn't exactly where it's at. I mean, these are more people who've done what America's always enabled people to do, and they understand it better than anyone. What you can do in America, if you're smart enough and lucky enough and have the class privilege to start out good, is that you can build yourself a niche without really kowtowing to any of the repressive forces in the society. All you need is some consciousness, mm-hmm. and then you can make your money, do your thing, and stay away from all the bad stuff. And that's what a lot of people are doing.
Could I just have a quick reaction? We've just got a minute left to your appreciation. What did Woodstock do? Was this just a great big musical jamboree, or was it expressing something deeper?
Well, it got a lot of people together. I mean, a lot of people didn't know that other people felt that way. You look around and you see 500,000 people who mm-hmm. technically think like you. That's pretty exciting. Whatever you're thinking, it's exciting to see any rally like that.
Right. But what got them together?
Well, I think what got them together is the fact that this popular music was really popular. And in addition, you had the growing of the repressive forces after the Chicago Convention and the election of Nixon. And so it was like a groundswell expression of solidarity that might not have happened
from that point of view.
Right.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the program. I've learned a great deal from you, Jim Lichtenberg and Lillian Roxon and Robert Christgau. Glad to have had you on the program, and we hope that you who have been watching have enjoyed it too. Next week, Religion and a New Generation.
From now on, today, the Woodstock Generation, the significance of rock. Your host, the Reverend Dr. David H.C. Reed, Senior Minister of the Madison Avenue Presbyterian Church in Manhattan. From now on, is produced by the Council of Churches of the City of New York in cooperation with WNBC-TV. This program was pre-recorded.